But I hope these two programs over the next two nights offer a kind of a range of the work that I've made over the last 40 or so years. And tonight's program is mainly films from the 20th century, ending with one film from the 21st. And tomorrow's program is a program of work from the 21st century, beginning with a film from the 20th. So, but I'm still doing the same thing as I have done for many years, really. So I think you'll see connections. I don't like to talk much about the films before you see them, but what I'd like to do is maybe show the first three pieces, and then I'll stop and talk a little bit. And then I'll show the fourth one and talk a little bit more, and then show the last two. And what I really hope is the most important thing is that you'll have some questions and we can talk at the end. So please do stick around, and assuming you're interested in the films, and talk afterwards. So I'm just going to say a little bit as things go along. The first film, it's great to be showing in the Film Museum because they have very good 16mm projection. So I'm showing the first four films that you'll see are all shot on film and shown on film, which is becoming more and more difficult nowadays. So you're going to see the last remaining prints of some of my early films. So we're going to start with a film called Om from 1986, which is 4 minutes long. A film from 1992 called Gargantuan, which is 1 minute long. And then a film from 1976 called The Girl Chewing Gum, which is 12 minutes long. The Girl Chewing Gum is the oldest film that I'm going to show tonight. Usually when I show a program of films, I show this film because it was very formative for me in my thinking about cinema, and it's led into a lot of other work later. So I usually show this film and talk about it, which I will do tonight. I always like to tell people how long films are. I don't know about you. I like to know how long I'm going to be sitting in a film or event. Yes, so I've told you how long those first four films are, adding up to about 16 minutes. One thing that's important to know is that I will tell you is Gargantuan, the 1 minute film, is exactly 1 minute long. It was actually commissioned by BBC Television and the Arts Council in England in 1992 for an arts magazine programme where they commissioned a number of artists over, I think, 3 years to make a 1 minute film, which was an intervention within this art magazine programme. So the only brief for the film was that it had to be 1 minute long. And as you'll see from the film, it's very much about being exactly 1 minute to the frame. Clear from the first three films, I'm really interested in ambiguity and how images and sounds can mean different things depending on the context that they're presented in. And film, of course, is an ideal medium for changing context, whether it's through how we use sound or words to determine how we see images, or whether sometimes images to determine how we hear sounds, how we edit and put one image against another and one sound against another. And of course, images and sounds are very mutable in how we read them. So almost all of my work plays with this kind of these kind of ideas. I like to show Om at the beginning of a program because that film, every element of it turns out to be something other than it led you to expect at the beginning of the film. So, many of my films work with expectation. And hopefully there's a kind of a game happening with the viewer. I hope as you could feel as though you can interact with what's going on presented on the screen. I'll just talk a little bit about The Girl Chewing Gum. Girl Chewing Gum was made when I was a student at the Royal College of Art in London in 1975-76. And at that time, as I'm sure many of you will know, many artists in Britain and internationally experimental filmmakers, whatever you'd like to call them, were making work which, in one way or another, was addressing the illusion of cinema. And the work had the ambition of drawing attention to the fact that you are looking at something which is an artifice. Of course, the opposite of the objective of mainstream cinema, which is to try to make us forget that we're watching a film. Many people at that time were making work which made you aware that you were watching a film. So I sort of grew up in that sort of environment. It was very, very influential to on me and still is. So when I made The Girl Chewing Gum, I was interested in making a film which really drew attention to the illusion of cinema by denying the existence of cinema, by actually treating what you see on the screen as an absolute reality in its own right, and hopefully through that device making you aware that you're looking at something which is not reality at all. You probably notice that there's no reference to cinema in the film. So instead of asking the camera to pan to the left, I ask the world to move to the right. Instead of asking the camera to zoom in, I ask everything to come towards me. And there are many kind of devices in the film like that, which hopefully draw attention to the fact that you're looking at something which is constructed. Quite late on in the film, I mention a red Jaguar car, which, of course, the power of illusion in cinema is so strong that after 3 seconds into the film, we've forgotten that we're watching a black and white film. Personally, I can't really understand the attraction of 3D cinema because the film is so immersive anyway. But anyway, that's another conversation. As I hope it's clear, or maybe you doubt about some things, but basically nothing in the film is directed. I just filmed what was happening in the street over the course of can't remember how many meters it is, 400, one roll of 16mm film, and did one take, and that was what the film was based around. And then afterwards I wrote a script of directions which I edited to match the image. But I got when I started putting the sound and the image together, I started to get my main interest started to become. I became very interested in the power of the word, power of the voice, and how that operated in the film. And I started to think of it really in relation to voiceover and documentary and things like this. And I was surprised when I sort of put the image and sound together how effective this device was. I don't mean to suggest, obviously, very quickly you all realise that these things aren't actually directed, but what I became interested in is that I think even though you know these things aren't directed, the power of the word is so strong that we still get drawn into it. So when the voice towards the end of the film says, I can see a man in a distance. When the voice appears to be telling the truth at last and says, I'm in a field 15 miles from the building you're looking at. In the distance, I can see a middle-aged man in a brown duffel coat, and he's got a dog with him, which looks like a Labrador. And I think he's got a helicopter in his pocket. I don't expect you all immediately dismiss that. The power of language is so strong that we can't help but try and rationalise things that we're told. So I expect some of you sort of just briefly thought, helicopter in his pocket? Helicopters are too big to have in your pocket. Is it a toy helicopter? You know. And of course, within the context of this film, you know you're being lied to. But it really made it clear to me just how powerful the word is in terms of determining how we see images. And ever since that time, I've had a kind of love-hate relationship with the power of language. I use word really to determine what we're looking at a lot, but it's a dangerous thing. I'm kind of trying to draw attention, I hope, to that danger a bit. Anyway, that's probably enough to say about that at the moment. We're going to go on to the longest film of the evening now, The Black Tower, which is 24 minutes long. Made, like a lot of my films, over quite a long period of time. This film's made over 3 years. I might talk a little bit about that later, but I think there are some elements in that you'll realise why it had to be made over a long time. The Black Tower, in a way, follows on from The Girl Chewing Gum in the fact that it uses a voiceover in relation to documentary-based images. But there are other elements in the film as well. It combines a lot of different things. I'm interested in making work which sort of, you know, what I call hybrid cinema, really, where you're not really quite sure how to place what you're looking at. So there are many different elements in this film that are very, very diverse elements that are drawn together within the one film. But that's what you'll see, so I won't tell you about it. Disappointed that people in the audience would say, how did you find so many of these identical towers? And then other people thought, fair enough, they thought it was a superposition, that I superimposed this building onto different landscapes. But following on from The Girl Chewing Gum, it's simply the same building photographed from different angles, and I use the voice to suggest that it's in different places. So the narrative actually comes out of the places where I could see the tower. The film's a little bit autobiographical in a way, in that the shot that you see at the end of the film across the graveyard with the tower in the background was a view from the bedroom window of a house that I moved into in Leytonstone in East London in the early 1980s. And I immediately became fascinated with this building. Partly because it had such a non-reflective black house on the top of this brick column that when the sun was behind it, it looked like a hole cut out of the sky. So it looked like a negative space on top of this plinth, which was really kind of fascinating visually, but also kind of in a way quite sinister. And I sort of knew I wanted to do something with this idea, and I asked my next-door neighbour, who I didn't realise, because I'd only just met him, he was a little bit of an eccentric character, and I said, what's that building? And he said, it's the psychiatric ward of the Old People's Hospital. And it is, in fact, an innocent water tower, emergency water supply for the hospital. But like a lot of tall buildings, and at that time, the area where I lived, there weren't many tall buildings around, you could see it from different places as you walked around this area. And because I wasn't familiar with the place that I'd moved to, sometimes I'd walk down the street and I'd turn a corner and I'd see it. And I'd think, oh, that's strange. I would have thought it would be a little bit more over to the east or the west. And so this sort of triggered the idea to make the film. And I was also interested in doing something which is to do with absence in the image, to have no image in the film. And you probably noticed there's quite a lot of the film where there's no image there. So I like the idea of taking this this black surface that could be different things. It could be no, it could just be film leader. It could be no image. It could be a night sky, or it could be the surface of the Black Tower on a sunny day. All of these images would look the same, and of course they're non-images, that they become images because of the context of the film. And it's sort of, the film tries to leave some space for the imagination there. When I was making the film, I read about a survey that BBC Television had done in the 1950s, when children's television had first started in Britain. And they'd had children's radio for a long time, but they started broadcasting children's television programs, and they wanted to know what children thought of them. And a really common response from the kids was, well, it's okay, but the pictures are better on the radio, aren't they? And I kind of agree with that, really. I mean, to me, I'm not interested in films which show kind of spectacular things, in a way. I think sometimes it's better not to be given too much. And of course, you're in some points in this film, you're not given very much at all. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more later on if people are interested. So we'll show the last two films. And as I say, I hope you'll be interested in sticking around and talking afterwards. The next film, like The Black Tower and The Gold Chewing Gum, is shot around the places where I've lived. I usually try not to leave my house to make a film, or if I do, I try not to go too far down the street. So Gold Chewing Gum was shot at the end of my street. A lot of The Black Tower was shot either from the windows of my house or in the streets around me. I mean, the season's changing in The Black Tower. I had a camera set up in the window of my studio, and I was just filming over one year, the tree coming into leaf and going. The next film you're going to see, Blight, is no exception to that. That's shot very much around the place where I lived, and you'll see what happened to the place. One of the houses you'll see in the film is my own house. It's different from all of my other films, really, Blight, because it's actually a collaboration with a composer. And as you'll see, the music track is a very important part of the film. I still am, in a way, quite wary about using music in film, because I'm scared of kind of emotionally manipulating too much. So my films generally kind of have a bit more distance. But I've also really over the years felt a bit of a coward for not trying out working with music. So as you'll see in this film, the music plays a very, very strong and dominant role. It's a collaboration with a composer called Jocelyn Pook that some of you may have heard of. It was commissioned by BBC TV, again, BBC TV and the Arts Council, for a series called Sound on Film, which were collaborations between filmmakers and composers. And one of the things that I was interested in with taking on the project was that it was had quite a big budget, bigger budget than anything else I'd ever done. And it enabled the composer and myself to work together throughout the production period. So right from the beginning, the composer was involved, and we were talking backwards and forwards. And as you'll see from the film, the image and sound are very, very integrated. So that's Blight. It's 14 minutes. Just one other thing is you'll hear fragments of voices in that film. And the voices come from the little extracts from conversations, interviews that I did with people who lived in around the place where I lived, where the film was shot. That's Blight, 14 minutes. And then the last film in the programme, a video, which is very much a video. It's called Unusual Red Cardigan. And I think you'll see why it is at the end of the programme, because it reflects back on a couple of things you've seen earlier. And it has a very different style to it. Unusual Red Cardigan is one of a number of video works that I've made in fairly recent years, where I'm trying to do things very, very spontaneously and trying to create a sense of immediacy. So the Unusual Red Cardigan is very raw. It's a single shot with no editing, and I'm recording sound simultaneously. So I'm filming and talking over the course of 12 minutes. And I don't think I need to explain it at all. So we'll show those last two films.
Your films are very unusual avant-garde films. In the way that they are really humorous. And I think also the side that you had introduced your own voice into the films and your narrative is very unusual for an experimental filmmaker, I would say. Yes, perhaps you could comment on it, why, when you have decided to start to put narratives in it, and yeah, because there wasn't any narrative for example,
I moved backwards and forwards between narrative because before Om I had made other work which has narrative elements to it, but it also depends what we mean by narrative. In a way, Om is a narrative film because it leads you from one point to another, but you're right, it doesn't have any words. As far as the humour side of it is concerned, I don't set out to make films that are funny. The kind of humour is a sort of byproduct of the ideas that I'm interested in working with, because I think because I'm interested in ambiguity and I'm interested in exploring situations where things appear turn out to be something different from what you expected, that naturally creates a humour when you realise that something's not what you thought it was. But that being said, I'm very glad that the work has a humour to it, because I've never been interested in making work for a kind of elite audience, for an audience who knows about experimental film or artist film or whatever. I'd like to think that anybody who's sort of a little open-minded can get something from the work, and of course humour is humour does make some otherwise difficult ideas accessible. So I think certainly within the educational world, my films often get used to kind of introduce students to experimental film because they're a kind of soft way in, in a way, to that world. That being said, I used to make some work which had no humour in it at all and was very dry and quite hard work. And I'm probably a little bit of a coward because I still like a lot of that work, but I don't often show it because I kind of want people to appreciate what I do. The great thing about having humour, of course, in work is that you can tell whether the audience are actually tuning into it because they make a sound. You know, I can hear you making a sound. Thank you.
So you said that you don't like to be manipulative before when the music, in the case of the music, but actually you are manipulating a lot your audience.
I could expand upon that. I didn't want to kind of talk about it much of the time. What I'm concerned about is manipulating the audience without them realizing they're being manipulated. So, I mean, my work is always very... I think you're very aware what's being done to you by the film, so that the manipulation is apparent. And the way in which I justify to myself the music in Blight is that although it's incredibly emotive and really kind of tells you how to read the images, you can't really not notice it. You're very aware of what's going on. My main objection to music in cinema is when it's used kind of insidiously, or you know, sort of when you have a low-level background, kind of ominous drone or something like that, where you're not necessarily, it's almost works subliminally, you're not really sure why you're feeling frightened in a horror film or whatever, you know, it's a problem I have with them. But the film, yeah, very much about, they, as you say, are very manipulative, and hopefully you know what's going on.
And the relationship between your words and the music and the images, so perhaps we could talk a little bit about the creation process. Is there writing before, or are there the images before, and is all found out at the moment of editing? Perhaps you can tell a little bit.
Is that in relation to Blight or generally?
Or? Yes, Blight or The Girl Chewing Gum or in general.
For me, the films that are edited, many of the ideas do come about during editing, so certainly... well, to take an example of The Black Tower, that was made over several years and actually ended up combining ideas for different films within one. I think I said earlier I'm interested in making work which is sort of hybrid, and in The Black Tower I really wanted to make a film which on one level was in fact the most conventional kind of narrative piece that I've made, but which also becomes completely abstract in other places. So there's a sort of tension between representation and abstraction and that sort of thing, one thing triggers another. But Blight particularly was very much of a journey to do with editing. Blight started off when I, by the way, I quite like it if people are suspicious about, you know, is this set up or is this something that you filmed. So, for example, the image of the Exorcist poster that you see in the film. Looks very improbable, but in fact, that was the house that was next door to my own, and And I was one of the last people to leave this area before all the when the houses were being demolished. So the house next to me was demolished while I was still living in my own house, which is why you see them doing with their hands, because that house is joined onto my house, and if they'd used heavy machinery, my house would have fallen down too. So, which was very fortunate for me, because I like this tactile sense of the builders, the demolition workers just destroying with their hands, because there's a kind of hopefully a sense of sort of a bit of respect for an old building, I don't know. But anyway, I knew I wanted to make a film about this place, things that were going on around me, and I delayed it for a long time. And then one evening, I'd been out all day, and I came home in the evening, and the house next door to me, having been completely standing that morning, I went into my back garden, and they started knocking down the back of this house. And I looked up, and there's this image of a mural, which was a copy of the poster for the film The Exorcist. And I thought, that has to be a motif for the film. So, and it was very poignant for me, because I'd lived in this house for 13 years, and the people next door had lived there that whole time as well. It was a family who'd lived there for a long time, growing up in this street, and I knew them, but I'd never been inside their house. And it was really strange to sort of suddenly this kind of rather obscene thing of like somebody's private world is exposed to you, and a rather strange private world. But there was a teenage boy who was one of the family, so I presume that he painted the mural on the wall. But anyway, I thought this has to be a motif, and I like this figure with the hat and the briefcase and the overcoat, because for me he represented the kind of faceless bureaucrat of the government department who have ordered the demolition of the houses. So, and it's for The Exorcist, so I decided I'd film the first part of the film where you don't see any human presence. So there's a sense I wanted to give this feeling that maybe there's a poltergeist in the house or something, you know, and the house is sort of self-destructing. And then, sorry, it won't take too long, but it's a little chain of things.
All the time.
So then I started filming the demolition workers, and then I noticed one of them had this spider web tattoo on his elbow. So I filmed that image, and I thought, oh, that's going to be part of it too, because it reminded me of the motorway network around London. It was also quite sinister, so it sort of fitted in with the poltergeist theme. So I thought, yeah, that's going to be a motif in the film. And then when I started interviewing people, all the people was talking in response to me, asking them about places that they remember that they can't return to. So it might be a house where somebody grew up, it might be in another country that they're never going back to, whatever. So it's all to do with I'm asking to remember these things about these places. And one woman started talking about when she was a child that toilet was in the garden, and she used to be frightened of going out into the garden to the toilet because of the spiders in the toilet, and she used to have to ask her father to kill the spiders. That became another element. So work often builds up in that sort of way. I mean, that was very lucky with that film, those things. But there's always accidents make things happen. I mean,
it's a very documentary approach. Actually, but the film in the end is very fictional or departing into fiction.
Well, I think the distinction between documentary and fiction is a bit overrated. Personally, I don't know, and I sort of rather make work where you're not quite sure. I mean, I think what's really important if you're showing images of the real world is that. It, or the representation of the real world in whatever way is that you don't just accept it, that you question them. So I like to have elements in the film where even if it's entirely factual, maybe you think, oh, is this a story? And I deliberately starts hopefully where you think, oh, is this a horror film? You know, what what is it? And it only gradually emerges that it concerns a particular subject. But just to go back to this thing of chance again, I mean, The Girl Chewing Gum, for example, as I said earlier, I only shot one shot for this film. And when I got the film processed, I was slightly disappointed that when I looked at the film, there's one point where I'd go to zoom in on the clock and I accidentally start zooming the wrong way, and I'm a bit fussy about these technical things, and I thought, oh, I can't stand to watch this, you know, it's horrible, this horrible jerky zoom. And then I thought, I can ask the clock to move jerkily towards me, and it does it perfectly. Did you see? It does exactly what I ask it to do. And the boy who's robbed the post office, he's robbed the post office because there was an alarm ringing when I was filming. I turned up to do the filming. As I said, I was a student at the time. I'd had to wait, 3 weeks to get the camera from the college. I turned up to do the filming, and this alarm was ringing, and I waited and waited, and it didn't. It didn't stop ringing, and I thought, "Oh fuck, I've got to film." You know? So then this irritating noise is there throughout the film, and I have to make this has to be an element. So I thought, okay, the boys are at the post office, the alarm's ringing. But the thing that was very fortunate about that was I chose the scene, the place, because I wanted to have a cinema in it, because it's a film about cinema. And I also wanted to have a clock because I wanted to direct the hands of the clock, so there was some point where you're clear that things are not being directed. But the fortunate thing was that I didn't know that there was going to be a queue of people coming outside the cinema, and it was only because I waited for so long that there was an afternoon screening, because it was in a school holiday, and this queue of people turned up, which actually makes it feel much more interesting than I've just been looking at an unopened cinema. There's a nice accident that actually I don't know if anybody noticed, but the film that's showing is a film called The Land That Time Forgot, which is which is a kind of fantasy film from the 1970s. But it was just so appropriate to me because, in a way, cinema is the land that land that time forgot, because we go into a cinema and we enter a different time frame.
So I would like to open it to the audience.
Did you follow if Saren Proffer, I guess was her name, tried to sell it again, perhaps for a lower price?
I did try and follow her. She seems to have vanished from the world. So I don't know. I did discover that she was trying to sell a sewing machine. An old sewing machine about a year after this, and that, as far as I know, that's the last time she sold anything on eBay, because I do Google alerts on her as well. Something occurred to me a little while ago. When I first made the film, I wasn't sure ethically, I thought, should I get in touch with this person? Because I actually did a gallery exhibition. The video, in a way, is a side shoot to a gallery exhibition that I did, where I exhibited these actual objects and made big screen grabs from the eBay advertisements, and I made these sort of iconic prints of 2 meter high cheerleading red pom poms, which were quite dramatic. And I thought, should I get in touch with her? And then I thought, well, I really don't want to, because I want her to remain a mystery, So I didn't. And I thought, should I do it? And I thought, no, it's okay. All I've done is I presented what she, what she's put into the public domain on the internet. I don't see that's an ethical problem there, particularly because also I was showing my own name and address in the video. So if I was making anybody vulnerable, it was myself. I wasn't telling people where her house was. It took me a long time to realise. I think somebody mentioned it in a Q&A like this, and they said, so what will happen if Saren Proffer does what you do and looks herself up on the internet? And you can try it at home if you like. If you look up Saren Proffer, you'll find all these references to my film. So I hope that she sort of found out about it that way. I was wondering whether she, when I bought the staff, I was wondering whether there'd be a note in the package, sort of thing. Are you that person who made the film? But there was nothing, and that was as it should be, I think. I did a screening in Cardiff in Wales, which is very near to Maesteg, where she came from. and there were people in the audience, and after the screening, everybody in the audience was saying, Maesteg is a really tiny town that doesn't have many experimental filmmakers in it, apparently. And people say, who can it be at Maesteg? You know, and someone, I know, there's this artist, his sister lives in Maesteg. Maybe, and he lived with her for a while. Maybe he left a tape at her house. It was terrible because the only discussion was about who Seren 4-4 might be. We didn't talk about the films at all.
Unpacking things like young girls buying makeup, for example, and then just showing them into the camera and saying, look what I bought today.
Yeah. I wasn't aware of it at the time. I was a real, you know, YouTube eBay virgin when I made that piece. Only maybe 2 months ago, somebody said that there's a whole load of these videos on YouTube. Yeah. I haven't looked for them. How would you search for them? Do you think?
Just write "hall" into YouTube, and you'll get.
Write what?
A hall. So like
hall. All right. Okay.
I've got a question. With the advent of a video, did your way of working change, or did it stay the same, or maybe you could talk about that?
Yeah, it changed a lot. I mean, my work's very led by technology, really, in different ways, because I like to do everything myself and I don't like to work with a crew. Very rare occasions I might work with somebody else, but it's not common, mainly because I work so slowly and I'm so indecisive that I can't keep people hanging around worrying about them. So certainly when I never ever considered working with video until the 1990s, because when I started working with film in the early 70s, the two media were so far apart that if you were interested in the aesthetics of the image at all, you wouldn't work with video, you know, because it was what was available to artists was very, very low resolution, black and white, reel to reel recorders where, you know, it was hard to see what was going on in the image a lot of the time. And when you edited, you could edit to like an accuracy of about 1 second if you got really good at it, because you had to do tape-to-tape editing. So I never considered working with video at all. But I always liked the idea of the immediacy of it, the possibility of doing something on your own where you could record image and sound simultaneously. So around the early 90s, when what do they call it? I've forgotten. Hi8 tape came out. It was a little bit precursor of DB. The quality of the image and sound started to be quite good, and I thought, okay, I'm interested in making some work using that possibility. But the video work was always like Unusual Red Cardigan, had a very different feel to it. It's very handheld and very very rough. So there's that film, and then there's an earlier piece called Home Sweet, which was shot in my house as well, which again is long, very long takes on a handheld camcorder. And then there's a whole series of videos called Hotel Diaries, some of which I'm going to show tomorrow. The changes are really the change in technology really make an enormous difference. I mean, I had no interest in working in video until Final Cut Pro. This is non-linear video editing that you can do on your computer at home came about, and I thought, okay, I can work at home using my own hardware and software. The work's really driven by those sorts of developments. Not least by the last two films you'll see tomorrow, or should I say videos, are HD and 16:9 ratio. I've spent my whole life working with a 4:3 ratio, and all of a sudden this widescreen came along, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with those bits down the side? What's the point of that? But then I thought, okay, I can film like wide shots of landscapes and things. For two reasons, partly because widescreen suits a landscape shot, but also because you probably noticed in my films most of the shots are really quite close. I don't film very many wide shots, mainly because 16mm film didn't really have the resolution to deal with a wide shot, whereas tomorrow you'll see a video called Flag Mountain that was shot in Nicosia, which shows a view of the whole city, and you can see tiny little details in the image which wouldn't be possible with film.
Do you want the water?
Okay. Try a bit of ventriloquism.
Did the BBC put you together with Jocelyn Pook, or was she your choice?
No, she's a close friend. She also lived in the... Her house was being demolished as well down the street. so that was the reason that I... She actually approached me about making the film, in fact, because I'd already started shooting the material for Blythe. And she's somebody who always works with very tight deadlines, and she approached me about a week before you had to have an application in, saying, oh, do you want to collaborate on making a piece together? And I thought, yeah, okay, fine. You know. And so we sort of brainstormed some ideas and didn't come up with anything. And then she sort of tentatively said, well, you know that film that you're making? It'd be great to do it with... to collaborate on that. And I thought, oh, no, it's, you know, because it's something I'd already developed in some way. Anyway, I gave in, and we worked together on that. That was kind of necessary because of the... I mean, hopefully it's quite hard for you as a viewer or listener to actually distinguish between the sound elements that I've produced and the sound elements that Joss has produced, because they're very much woven together. We did two dubs, in fact. We did a music dub and a film dub, because each of us came from a different world, and we both thought, I've got to do my kind of dub, you know. So it was, fortunately, there was a budget that covered it, unusually for an artist film.
Other questions? Yes, please.
I was puzzled by the soundtrack of the first movie on. First, I thought it was a guy, you know, or somebody doing circular breathing like Marlon mm-hmm. Kirk, you know, or something. And then that didn't seem too plausible. How did he actually do the on?
Well, being it's me actually dubbed onto him. I just went on for as long as I could. Yeah. Which was probably about 30 seconds, and then made a loop. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear the join. If you actually, that's one good thing about a 16mm optical soundtrack, because it has a little crackle on it. You won't, you probably won't hear the join. But unfortunately, I didn't know any circular breathers that I could bring in to dub it, and it was hard enough getting this guy to actually do it. Just sit still without blinking and have his hair cut and just look straight at the camera, so I didn't want to ask him to make sound as well.
How did that idea come about? Or do you have a lot of ideas and jot them down, or do you sort of just say, I need to make a film and then think, or what's your process?
That's a difficult one. I don't have a lot of ideas. I used to have a lot of ideas when I was young. I don't have hardly any ideas now. I used to be a different process, because when I first started making films, they were, as you saw, all 16mm, so they required, you know, funding to make. I couldn't afford to actually pay for them myself. And at that time, the only funding available in Britain for artists was the Arts Council, who had an annual meeting of their Artists, Film and Video Committee in November. So every October, I'd think, sit down and have an idea. And usually they'd come up. I don't have ideas really hardly ever. Except when the work's going. Once the work's started, then I have lots of ideas about how to work with it. But actually, the idea to start a film, I don't know. I mean, actually came about because the London Filmmakers Co-op was celebrating its, what would it be, 20th anniversary in 1986. And they asked people to make a 100-foot film of a one roll 60mm film. I cheated a bit, it's a bit over 100 feet, but I made it for that that context, actually. Yeah, it's usually things come about because now I usually only have an idea if somebody asks me to, if I get a commission and somebody says, you know, we'd like you to make a piece of work. I like limitation, actually, as well. I mean, it's great to make a film like Gargantuan where I was told you have to, you know, it's got to be 1 minute. You know, and then I just thought pretty literally about 1 minute and an idea came up. It's too many possibilities. Because there's so many things you can do, for me that kind of limits my ideas. I don't think of anything, you know. But somebody says, can you do something within this little framework? Then usually an idea comes up the next day. It's very frustrating.
So the limitation is it valuable for the creation process? Is it important for you to get an an input from the outside from a commissioner or?
I don't want input from a commissioner. No, I usually get really. I'm very bad about that. So, yeah. If they are
to imagine perhaps also the kind of situation where the film will be seen, because you are exposing your films in exhibitions, actually, mm-hmm. and also on festivals. Perhaps mm-hmm. you could talk a little bit about these both sides.
Yeah. Well, the films get shown in a much broader situation than they did when I first started making work. So, when I first started working, there were very few seeing artists' film and video work in a gallery exhibition was very rare, and that's only really become common over the last 15 to 20 years. And so that was an interesting change, because I'd always made work which is very linear. I mean, everything you've seen today is very linear work, and I want people to come in and watch it from the beginning to the end and not go in and out and come in the middle. And But like we were saying a minute ago about changes in technology influencing the work, for me the opportunities to show in a gallery have affected the work as well. And sometimes I've made work which is very much devised to be seen as a loop and without beginnings and middles and ends, which works better in that context than in cinema. I find a limitation is really important. You know, I mean, The Girl Chewing Gum is one roll of film, one long roll for the first part and one short roll for the second part, and to me that's a sort of important thing. You make a rule, once you make some rules for yourself, that's good. I mean, there's a video that I'm not showing here at the moment, but one of the other few collaborations I've done, but with another artist called Graham Miller, called Lost Sound, where the video revolves around finding bits of audio cassette tape in the street. A few years ago now, you don't see so much audio cassette tape in the street, but when we made the video around about 1998 to 2000, very often if you walked around the area of East London, where I live, you might see a bit of tape blowing caught in a tree or a fence or wrapped around a lamppost. And the Lost Sound is based on a really simple idea, which actually led in lots of different directions. But the idea is basically find bits of tape in the street, film them in their natural habitat, wherever you find them, like a natural history film, as if it's an anthropomorphic creature blowing in the wind, and film whatever's happening around it in that place, and then afterwards rescue the tape and unravel it and put it into an audio cassette and play it, so that it becomes two kinds of accident. One is that the places that are recorded and the events that are recorded are determined by where the tape is found, and the sound that the shot has over it is determined by what the sound is on the tape. And So I love those kind of ways of working, because then you can just do it once you've got the idea. But then other things come out of those accidents.